Good afternoon, everyone. If I can get your attention, please. We're going to get ready to start our program here today, and we are very lucky to have our wonderful Congresswoman and Coastal Champion here today. Congresswoman Lois Capps is going to kick things off for us. Thank you.
Well, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you for letting me just come right in and walk right up and don't have to even prove myself, right? Am I among friends? I think I am. I just came from office hours in Santa Maria, so this is a nice setting, I must say. I'm very honored to be part of this discussion and get things going for the Marine Sanctuary Alliance. I'm not getting things going. You all are getting things going, and I salute you in those efforts. Thank you to our organizers. Thank you to Amanda, whom I've known for quite a while, for introducing me, Sierra Club with Andrew Christie and Surfrider. How many Sierra Clubs are here, members are here, and then we'll see a show. Maybe some of you are both Surfrider and Sierra Club, but let's see, Surfrider is here too. You have a strong, this is the alliance, right? This is great. And we have some wonderful panelists here, I understand, from Monterey County. Dan Heifley, Executive Director of O'Neill Sea Odyssey in Santa Cruz. You're going to be speaking next, but do we all know who you are? Oh, good. Randy Wadera, Friends of Santa Cruz State Parks. You are here. Good. Cynthia Matthews, Santa Cruz City Council and former mayor. Great. And Dr. Christopher Harold, Director of Conservation Research at Monterey Bay Aquarium. Super. Maybe there are others who are here as well, then you'll introduce them. I know that we have our third district supervisor, Adam Hill, here with his assistant. And we also have Phyllis Molnar from Grover Beach City Council. Do we have some other elected officials that we need to identify? Well, thank you both for being here. I am so proud to represent the neighboring communities of the Central Coast next door to Santa Cruz. And this district, the 23rd Congressional District, spans more than 200 miles of coastline. It includes two national marine sanctuaries, a national forest and a national estuary, two national monuments, and a national park and wildlife refuge. So we have a lot of challenges and opportunities, but much to be thankful for. The well-being of this area depends on the health of our oceans, very, very dependent, and the natural resources that are surrounding us all. I'm fortunate because even though I'm going back to Washington, D.C. on Monday morning, I'm coming back home to the district on Thursday. And this is our routine. Sam Farr does it, all of us who represent coastal districts. We can't stay away very long, so we come home when we can. The Pacific Ocean, for me, is a constant reminder of just what is at stake here. Our country is still in the midst of an economic recovery, and we face difficult choices, so there are many challenges now with the goals that we have. But we continue to be confronted with the very real threat of global warming. We cannot let these challenges deter us from investing in our coasts and our oceans. Not only are they magnificent ecosystems in themselves, but they also provide strong economic foundation for the communities in which we call our home and where we live. And I think it's important during a recession to emphasize that we need our natural resources for their economic value as well as for their intrinsic worth. We all recognize that we are in some tough fiscal times and budgets are being trimmed across the board. But I am especially troubled by the underfunded ocean programs of NOAA. The proposed NOAA budget total is just $5 billion. And the percentage cut from NOAA oceans programs over the past 2 years is 14%. The reason it matters so much now is that the amount the ocean economy contributes to the GDP annually is $118 billion. Most people don't stop and think about that when they consider budget cuts. The number of jobs that depend on the oceans and coasts is more than 2.3 million. So these are no small figures. And we need the organizations and the safeguards in place that our institutions provide for us to make sure that, especially in these economic tough times, that regulations aren't cut in the name of economic progress. You know, that's the argument people want to take. Right now, the proposal that's before Congress to pay for the transportation reauthorization legislation, a vital program that we need for our infrastructure, they want to pay for it by drilling in the Arctic Wildlife Refuge, and they want to drill off California's coast. The only way they can do that is to gut NEPA and CZMA, which they're willing to do. So these are the stakes that are before us today in the place where Sam Farr and I have to go back to work on Monday. But we can't afford to take these cuts in our protections because we need the strong economic base that our oceans provide for us. What's at risk is funding for regional and state partnerships as well. One example is the West Coast Governor's Agreement on Oceans Health. This was an achievement to get the governors into a position where we could align, and they would see that they have a lot at stake in their alliance. But to gut the partnership and the funding for keeping it alive is a huge step backwards, as well as the science to guide wise decision making. We need the programs that are in place at our campuses at Santa Cruz and Cal Poly and Santa Barbara, UC Systems, to make sure that we stay on track and that we develop, along with the science that's available for us, the kinds of guidelines for the future. And we cannot afford to have cuts to coastal mapping and navigation buoys, which help us collect the data that we need for this very science to help us understand the ways that we need to continue protecting our resources. And lastly, we're facing losing funds which monitor coastal pollution and protect and restore habitats for fishing and recreation. Now we want to move forward with a national ocean policy. This is something Sam Farr and others of us have been working on for many years. Because NOAA's role is vital to our economy, I have the goal of working to restore the funding that's been cut. I also support President Obama's national ocean policy. The United States lacks a comprehensive strategy for our oceans. We already have one for air and water, but we have nothing in place at this time for our oceans. It's a job that can start with your discussion here today and build on the local coalitions such as is represented here in this room. You can give us the foundation from which to build an ocean policy. I support moving to an ecosystem-based coastal and marine spatial planning and management, the CMSP. Spatial planning is already working in the United States, and it's something we need to strengthen, particularly as we think of developing alternative energy sources from our oceans. We want to, as we replace those platforms offshore that dot the shoreline in Santa Barbara County, we know we want to be able to harness wave energy and some of the other cutting-edge technologies that are there, but we don't want to wait until decisions are made. We want to be out front with the spatial planning guidelines in place so that as our oceans policy is developed, we will have the design in place to guide this. I will wind this up in a second, Amanda. Now, to the point of our being here today, sanctuaries. The best example of coastal and marine spatial planning is contained in our national marine sanctuaries. And that's why we're here today to talk about this program. Now, as I said earlier, budget challenges for NOAA are real, especially as they affect our sanctuaries. These cuts will impact the services that our sanctuaries provide, from tourism to sustainable fisheries. And I know we have lots of data that's being collected in each of these areas. So I appreciate the alliance building support for our sanctuary protection on the Central Coast. I'm also very pleased that the Monterey Bay Sanctuary Foundation is reaching out now to the Channel Islands Sanctuary, which does not yet have a foundation, and that we can develop such a partnership with the existing foundation that's in place in Monterey Bay. We are definitely partners in this business, the two sanctuaries. And as I know, we're thinking about the gap in between and ways that that can be connected. We have much to be thankful for with our existing sanctuaries. This is such a special and unique ecosystem. And I am the last one to need to tell you about that. You're the experts. So filling the gap has merit. Enhancing protection is something I'll always support. But we have to strengthen public support for this plan, locally, statewide, and nationally. For example, I've backed my friend Lynn Woolsey's bill to expand the sanctuaries on the North Coast, the Gulf of the Farallones and Cordell Bank. Although we faced opposition in the House of Representatives, we made the case that expansion was good for both the environment and the economy. So we have a precedent there in that expansion, if that's something you care to look at. I want to keep working with you to protect these special waters. We can only accomplish our goals through innovation and collaboration, and you're demonstrating that the collaborative part of it is right here and is thriving and well. An example are the fishermen environmental groups who have teamed up to protect the fishing in Morro Bay. Partnerships such as this one are a great way to combat the many challenges facing our oceans and coasts. The key is consensus building. It's having all the stakeholders at the table, even if in the beginning you don't all agree, but you find a common touch point, a common language, and you begin to build consensus where it exists, where the first steps are, and then expand, and it's amazing what can be accomplished with patience and perseverance. And there are many examples for ways that this is done. You know, there are many hurdles that lie ahead of us. We know that, but we will get there. Congress thinks protecting oceans and coasts means more drilling, the Congress that's in the majority where I work today. We have, those of us in the minority, have our work cut out for us, and we can't do this without the support of grassroots organizations like is represented in this room today. But our administration is committed to tackling environmental problems, even though they face some tough fiscal challenges. So we'll come together at this level and work on some solutions, and they'll be examples for Sam Farr and I to use in Washington, D.C. Your job as citizens and constituents is to keep talking about these issues, even in the face of economic tough times. The issue is too important for us to sit on the sidelines, and that's why I'm so pleased to see so many of you here today, and I look forward to being in touch with our office. Greg Haas and Rachel Condor are both in the back, one in our San Luis Obispo office, one in Santa Barbara, reaching between, covering the coastline, and only a phone call or an email away if you have concerns that you want to get to our office. So I look forward to continuing to work with all of you to better manage our oceans and our coasts, and what's happening today, it gives me great hope and optimism for the future. And thank you for letting me join you. Look forward to the discussion. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Congresswoman Capps. We are truly lucky to have someone representing this area who's going to bring back our message of conservation to Washington. So it's always great to have good people in power there. My name is Amanda Wallner, and I'm the organizer for the California Coast Resilient Habitats Campaign. The Resilient Habitats Campaign is a national effort by the Sierra Club to preserve America's wild legacy and minimize the loss of wild places and biodiversity due to climate change. We've launched a national effort designed to have a major impact in every state, including a concentrated effort in 10 unique regions throughout the country, including one here along the California coast. As part owners of our natural heritage, all Americans have a shared responsibility to protect wildlife and wild places for future generations. Today, our outdoor legacy faces new and growing threats, from destructive energy development to unsustainable logging and a changing climate. We must protect, connect, and restore wetlands and waterways to function as healthy natural systems, not just individual pieces, to create resilient habitats where plants, animals, and people can survive and thrive on our changing planet. Right here in the Central Coast, right now, we have a unique opportunity to be a part of this effort and leave behind a vibrant legacy for our children and our grandchildren. Creating a national marine sanctuary in San Luis Obispo reflects a growing national tide. Despite what Congresswoman Capps has said, there is enthusiasm throughout the country for protecting wild places. Just recently, President Obama designated a new national monument on the East Coast, and they're looking at doing it again here in the Central Coast. So we really do have momentum behind us to get this done. As you'll hear, a healthy natural world also feeds a healthy economy. Outdoor recreation, from bird watching to biking, provides millions of dollars and jobs to local economies. The speakers who follow me will expand on what a national marine sanctuary in their backyards has meant to business. And surely the economic case for protecting this beautiful area is strong. The reason that the world's best and brightest flock to California is because their backyard boasts some of the most iconic and iconic landscapes and beloved wildlife in the world. And if there's an enduring image of California in the minds of most Americans, and in fact people worldwide, it's probably the coast, the dramatic meeting of land and water. California beaches attract more than 12 million visitors every year to come surf, fish, and play along our shores. And it's no wonder that the Resilient Habitats campaign has chosen the California coast as one of its spotlight regions, nor why the California Coast campaign has chosen to focus on permanently preserving the area right outside these doors. We have a responsibility to protect wildlife and wild places so that future generations can connect with special places outdoors that continue to shape our uniquely American identity. Please enjoy the speakers that follow, and I hope that you will join us in our efforts to create a national marine sanctuary in San Luis Obispo. So please, after we're done here, find myself or find Andrew Christie there in the back, and we would be happy to have your help in this effort. Thank you.
My name is Brad Snook. I'm the chair for our Surfrider, our local county chapter of the Surfrider Foundation. I'd like to thank the Marine Sanctuary Alliance activists, Carol Georgie, Carl Kempton, Jeff Pinak. I'd like to thank Andrew Christie and the Sierra Club, all the work that they do for the National Marine Sanctuary Alliance, that the National Marine Sanctuary is not only necessary, but it's also feasible. I'd like to introduce the speakers for today. Dr. Christopher Harold is Director of Conservation Research at the Monterey Bay Aquarium. He's conducted research and field work from the high intertidal zone to 2 miles below the ocean surface. Dr. Harold chairs the Sanctuary Advisory Council and the Research Activities Panel of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. Cynthia Matthews, 3-term mayor of Santa Cruz, actively involved in planning for the Sanctuary Exploration Center, now under construction near Santa Cruz's main beach. She was recently appointed to the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary Advisory Council. Randy Wadera founded the Web of Life Field School in 1989. Nationally recognized for excellence in interpretation and education support, developed effective public and private alliances, helped build thriving local communities that sustain our environment and honor our heritage. Dan Haefley, executive director of O'Neill Sea Odyssey since 1999, leading advocate for hands-on environmental education, chairs the Santa Cruz County Commission on the Environment. Going to begin with Dan's insights into how the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary came to be. Take it away, Dan.
PowerPoint. First of all, driving up here with Cynthia and Randy, I kept thinking about a gentleman named John Von Reese, who is anybody in this room familiar with that name? One person at least. When we were involved in creating the sanctuary, Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, back in the late 80s and early 1990s, John was the lead planner for the county of San Luis Obispo, and he attended many of the hearings, and his mantra was always the same, which is you can just take that proposed boundary of the sanctuary, which is at the bottom of Big Sur, at the county line there, and just move it south. Everything will be good. And it was actually an excellent presentation that he made. He made a good scientific case. Unfortunately, at the time, that case was not picked up, but it appears that you all have taken up the cause here, and I really appreciate your doing that. So I'm going to talk a little bit about how the sanctuary was formed. And I know every situation is different, but for us in Monterey Bay, what is a big part of our marine sanctuary is the definition of what we don't see. We don't see offshore oil drilling in Monterey Bay, especially from Monterey Bay north to Point Reyes, which is where the Cordell Bank and the Gulf of the Farallones National Marine Sanctuary all. This is an area of continuous protection against offshore oil because a ban on offshore oil is codified in those three national marine sanctuaries that start with Monterey Bay and then Gulf of the Farallones, Cordell Bank. We also don't see onshore facilities to support offshore oil, and I'll talk a little bit about why that's the case. So what we're protecting is mostly what you see underneath the waves, life below the surface and life that is on and above the surface as well. So how did this happen? I'm going to make the case that a lot of this happened due to a political set of circumstances. In 1992, we had a president named George H.W. Bush. And he was running for re-election. That didn't work out so well. We had another gentleman who won that election named Bill Clinton. His choice that he made, and I'll refer to the choice here in a minute, his choice relative to California's coastline did not get him re-elected, but it had a huge impact on California and one quarter of California's coastline in the creation of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. So momentum really started with an effort started by the city of Santa Cruz. This is going back to the 1980s. There had been on-again efforts to promote the idea of federal offshore oil drilling from 3 to 200 miles offshore. Federal government controls oil drilling within this area, the exclusive economic zone, the area from the mean high tide line out to 3 miles controlled by state government. And of course, everything on land is controlled by local governments. So because local governments, particularly in California, had very little control over what was going on in federal lease lands that could be drilled for oil, local governments tried to come up with a strategy to get at the question of offshore oil. So one was developed by a group of folks, including our current California's current Secretary for Natural Resources, John Laird, was part of this effort, some county supervisors and citizens. And they decided to concoct an idea, which they put on the ballot in Santa Cruz in 1985, which is to, A, ban onshore facilities for offshore oil. So dewatering facilities, pipelines, helicopter pads, anything related to offshore oil, and then have an escape valve that if you had a strong case to present for having an onshore facility support offshore oil, that you would take that case to the voters. The second part of the ballot measure was to allocate funds to promote this very idea up and down the California coastline. So that was put on the ballot in 1985, and 82% of Santa Cruz City voters agreed with that. So Save Our Shores was hired by the city to take on that effort. I was hired to coordinate it. And Save Our Shores at that time had a strong track record in organizing around federal offshore oil proposals to that point. So we traveled the coastline, and eventually we were able to persuade 26 cities and counties from San Diego to Humboldt to pass laws, and laws were different in each community that would have some form of control over onshore facilities for offshore oil drilling, most of them requiring a vote. Many of these laws were approved by voters, which formed the basis for citizen efforts in all these communities. So you're building quite a movement throughout California in the mid and late 1980s. As I mentioned before, the federal government controls offshore oil drilling, but not what happens on land. Local government controls their own zoning. However, the oil industry raised a point with this. They said, we have a federal activity that's protected by the Commerce Clause. Oil that's produced off California would be transported across state lines and used throughout the United States. What you're doing in your local governments by passing these local ordinances is you're creating an impediment to us. Therefore, what you're doing is unconstitutional. You're violating the Commerce Clause. So the Western Oil and Gas Association, which was later renamed the Western States Petroleum Association, filed a lawsuit against 13 of the local governments. And then, as is the case now, most local governments were starved for funds. So those 26 ordinances, the momentum for more, started to slow down once they saw a lawsuit. But we had gotten their attention. So this was going on. At the same time, there was a parallel effort going on. U.S. Representative Leon Panetta was still in Congress at the time. He had been elected in 1976. And he had been working to establish marine sanctuary status for Monterey Bay. And his thought then was Monterey Bay proper. This was not seen as necessarily an effort related to offshore oil drilling. In 1972, he was able to do this because in 1972, the Sanctuary Act was approved by Congress and actually was part of a larger effort that was spurned by the Santa Barbara oil spill in 1969, protected water quality, created the Marine Sanctuary Program, and did a lot of other things. And then the California Coastal Commission immediately went to work on a couple of sites off California as potential sanctuary candidate sites. One of those was Monterey Bay. So then Representative Panetta in 1976 began working on and being the voice in Washington for this effort to create marine sanctuaries, while the Coastal Commission was working at home to establish the scientific case for each of these sites, one of them being Monterey Bay. There had been a couple of efforts, and one stalled because of opposition from the fishing community. In 1988, he was able to finally secure authorization for NOAA to create a marine sanctuary in Monterey Bay. And again, the idea was Monterey Bay proper, which is generally perhaps including the Big Sur coast, but most definitely including the area from Point Joe and Pacific Grove up to and possibly as far north as Año Nuevo. So at the same time, Panetta was working on the offshore oil drilling issue by securing a yearly moratoria on funds that would be used to plan by the Department of Interior to allow for drilling of offshore oil. So these two things were going on in parallel. So the environmental community saw an opportunity with marine sanctuary status where you could codify a ban on offshore oil drilling to try and prohibit offshore oil drilling forever, essentially, and not have to go year after year and support Panetta's moratorium against planning for leasing federal leases. So to re-engage with the process that was underway to plan for a sanctuary in Monterey Bay, the Environmental Working Group was formed in 1988. There are a group of us, Rachel Saunders, who's been very active with the sanctuary, which is the Big Sur Land Trust now. She worked with an organization called the Center for Marine Conservation, which is now the Ocean Conservancy. We had a group of environmental, a coalition of environmental groups that worked on this, including the Surfrider Foundation, the Sierra Club, League of Women Voters. And again, we were working in parallel with Leon Panetta and his organizations. He had a working group, including Joe Stollard, a longtime environmentalist, Dick Nutter, who is an agricultural commissioner. So everybody was working towards the same goal, though we were taking different methods, different approaches. And the different approaches we were taking soon showed up in the different configurations of what a Monterey Bay Sanctuary would look like. As this planning effort went on, there were seven different boundary options that were being examined for the sanctuary. And the map that you see up here is what exists today. And astonishingly, that was the largest boundary of the seven options. Every other option was smaller. And the thought was, as in many planning processes, is that the largest boundary and the most restrictive configuration in terms of regulations would not necessarily be the one to be chosen. Well, in this case, it was. Had little to do with the planning process. It had a lot to do with politics. So that boundary, the one that we eventually got, was called Boundary Option 5. It would have protected the coast north of Davenport and south of Point Reyes. And why that's important is, at that time, technology for offshore oil drilling dictated that you couldn't necessarily drill off Big Sur because the nature of the geology and geography. That may be different today, but this is 20 years ago. But in fact, starting at Davenport and moving north, there were areas under active consideration by the oil industry because seismic testing that had been done back in the 60s and some on-land testing done at Ani Nuevo had shown that there was great potential for oil development. And this would start around Davenport and move north up to the southern boundary of the Gulf of the Farallones National Marine Sanctuary, which is a shared boundary, and it's that boundary up north of San Francisco Bay there, that green line at the top. So supporting Boundary 5 essentially was the environmental community. Others were supporting smaller boundaries because at the time that was the smart, politically smart thing to do. You have to remember that at this time we were at war in the Middle East. It was 1990, the first Iraq war, over oil. Oil prices were going up. And we know what happens about discussion of oil drilling, domestic oil production, when gas prices go up. So we had to be very, very careful. Luckily, the decision was not made in 1990 during this. Luckily for us, the decision was made in 1992. It was a presidential election year. So we had to build a case for this large boundary. And part of that is showing that there is essentially a discrete ecosystem, showing that you have an area that is important to protect the whole piece of this geographic area because you're protecting different areas where the life cycle of certain species that are protected or need protection will occupy, that you have unique species there, that this is a special place biologically to protect. So one example of this was the Fitzgerald Marine Reserve, and I point this out because one of our challenges was to make sure that we had continuous protection north to Gulf of the Farallones so we can protect this area with oil reserves and of interest to the oil industry from offshore oil. And parallel to that, we were looking for pieces that would show that this was an interesting, unique ecosystem, and one of those was the Fitzgerald Marine Reserve that was strategically located and contained unique species in a reef environment. This is actually just north of what people know as the Mavericks Wave, north of Pillow Point Harbor. It's a very interesting little reserve, and I won't go into the biology of it now, but it was something that caught the attention of the planners at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration at the time. So there was, interestingly enough, the effort to pull this scientific information together was funded by oil royalty money. We're running out of time. Okay, so I'll hurry it up. Six coastal counties had taken their share of oil royalty money and used it to fight offshore oil. One of the ways they did that was by pulling their resources on these studies. So 4,000 people attended these public hearings. John Von Reese from San Luis Obispo was one of them. I made written comments. We made several presentations. We worked the issue. Two oil spills in 1989 and 1990 compelled this effort, and I'm talking fast to save time. We worked with folks in San Luis Obispo at the same time and continued the effort against offshore oil. In 1990, the Gulf War, as I mentioned before, delayed sanctuary designation. In 1990, then-President Bush announced a 10-year moratorium on offshore oil. There were the 87 tracts off San Luis Obispo County that were included as a sidebar to that. We continued our work for the sanctuary and against offshore oil. In 1992, President Bush was running for re-election. He was behind in the polls in California. Stuart Spencer, an old-time operative who had worked on Reagan's campaign, says the way you win back California is by banning offshore oil and approving the largest boundary for the Monterey Bay Sanctuary. He did it. We got it. That's a true story. So the announcement was made. It stunned us all. We had taken a risk supporting the large boundary, and guess what? That's what we got. There were flaws to the plan, and the last management plan review of the Sanctuary Advisory Council and the Monterey Bay Sanctuary staff, there was an effort to correct some of these flaws. But essentially, we got a lot of what we were asking for. And again, it was a matter of timing and politics and science all combined. So it was an improbable victory. We were lucky. And again, the Gulf War delayed the designation. That put us into a presidential election year. I think that's going to conclude my remarks. So I apologize for going over time.
Dr. Harold, you're up, and at this time, why don't we just have all the panelists come up and take your seats at the panel there.
Well, Dan, thanks for that history of the sanctuary. My name is Chris Harold. My day job is at the Monterey Bay the Monterey Bay Aquarium, but I spent a lot of time with the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. I've been on the sanctuary's research activities panel, which is a working group of the sanctuary since the sanctuary's inception in 1992, and I've been on the Sanctuary Advisory Council for the past 12 years, and I've been its chair for the past 4 years. And full disclosure here, I am a shameless advocate and cheerleader for sanctuaries. So if you're looking for an unbiased view of the value of sanctuaries to coastal communities, I am not the person to give that unbiased view. But my views are based on experience and my knowledge of marine ecosystems and my knowledge of the threats that marine ecosystems face. March, I gave a talk at the National Summit of SAC Chairs. One of the perks of being a Sanctuary Advisory Council chair is you get to go on an all-expenses-paid trip to one of the 13 marine sanctuaries in the nation. This one was in Savannah, Georgia, at Gray's Reef. And I was part of a panel that was asked to address the question, in general, what role does your National Marine Sanctuary play in sustaining local economies, and what sectors of your economy have benefited? And my other panelists were from Thunder Bay on Lake Huron and the Great Lakes, Florida Keys, Monterey Bay, and Channel Islands. Before I get to that, I think it's helpful to step back and ask what the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary was intended to do. And if you look at the designation document, it's quite specific. The intended effect is to protect the conservation, recreational, ecological, historical, research, education, and aesthetic resources and qualities of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. Elsewhere in the designation document, it says the highest priority management goal is to protect the marine environment, resources, and qualities of the sanctuary. So this is, at least in our area, that Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary is the only federal agency whose entire goal, entire jurisdiction, is resource protection. The designation document gives guidance on how you do that. There's 9 objectives. I won't go through them, but there's a lot about coordinating, encouraging participation, enforcement, promoting public awareness, and reducing threats to sanctuary resources. So, how does the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary sustain local economies? I am unaware of any quantitative published account that will give you specific numbers on how the sanctuary actually contributes to local economies. But again, from my experience and watching how the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary operates, I would offer the following. In my view, there's sort of short-term benefits where you can actually show, yeah, the Marine Sanctuary, their activity has contributed directly to these activities, which almost certainly generated revenue in the short term. And by short term, I'm thinking 1 to a few years. So it provides fuel to the local economic fire. And then there are long-term benefits, which are much more difficult to quantify, but probably in the end, I think they're much more important. And that is to protect marine resources for current and future generations, not just for their aesthetic values, but protecting marine ecosystem function and marine ecosystem integrity, which provides ecosystem services, which in the long run contributes to economic health. This is my dad and my granddaughter, who is 1 year old. 1 year old. And looking at this picture, there are four generations that separate those two people. My dad's 85, and Isabella is one. And when my dad was 1 year old, he grew up on this coast, was born in Atascadero, and the ocean was a very different place when he was 1 year old. Now that Isabella's one wonders, I certainly wonder what will the ocean look like when she is sitting at 85 years old, sitting in that chair, bouncing her great-granddaughter on her knee. What will that ocean look like? And I feel a very strong responsibility to ensure that that ocean is as healthy as it can be, and I think the National Marine Sanctuary Program is a great way to accomplish that. So a few of the short-term immediate benefits. The sanctuary was a huge contributor to bringing the Blue Ocean Film Festival from the East Coast to the West Coast. This is now an annual film festival that brings filmmakers, underwater filmmakers from all over the world. In 2011, it brought in 9,000 people, $600,000 alone just from the film delegates. There were 10,000 online viewers on the website, restaurant, hotel, retail spending spiked. It's now an annual event, and the sanctuary played a critical role in bringing Blue Ocean Film Festival here. They helped with planning. They sponsored the Bruckner Chase swim from Santa Cruz Point to Monterey. That's a 23-mile swim in really cold water. In that particular swim was jellyfish infested, and he was a mess when he got done, but it generated a lot of public relations and press for the event. They brought in exhibitors. They oversaw the flip cam checkout and undertook screenings of student films. The sanctuary engages in business partnerships. These are five for the hotels, and including the Monterey Peninsula Airport. The sanctuary provides video clips that run in the hotel rooms. They provide a running video loop at baggage claim at the airport. The sanctuary can permit exemptions to one of the nine or so prohibitions in the sanctuary, and by doing so, they promote promote events and economic activities. Maverick's Big Wave Surfing Competition is now an internationally known event. Motorized personal watercraft in the sanctuary are restricted to specific zones, but the sanctuary allows for the use of those motorized personal watercraft as safety vehicles during the Maverick's surfing competition. Caltrans, that tries to maintain Highway 1 despite the fact that nature wants to destroy Highway 1, allows Caltrans to discard side casting in a way that's environmentally minimizes the environmental footprint. They allow fireworks displays and other permits that allow events to happen in the sanctuary. Now turning to some of the long-term benefits, outreach is one of the really important and I think most successful things that the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary does. There's a Coastal Discovery Center here in San Simeon, and there is about to be a Sanctuary Exploration Center opened up in Santa Cruz. That is scheduled to open this July. Up in San Simeon, that Discovery Center is done in partnership with California State Parks. They have 30 volunteer docents. They get 15,000 visitors annually. They host a coastal discovery fair. They have school programs, family field trips, and a lecture series. Up in Santa Cruz, the Discovery Center is right on the boardwalk. The city of Santa Cruz is a huge and enthusiastic partner for the coastal for the Discovery Center. It broke ground in November of 2010 and anticipates opening in July of this year. The plan is to see at least 150,000 visitors a year, and they anticipate that thousands of school students will come and use the Discovery Center. Education programs, I think this is one of the most innovative education programs that the sanctuary does, and that is helping students understand about the commercial fishing heritage of the Monterey Bay region. There's a program called Fishermen in the Classroom, where the sanctuary facilitates bringing actual working commercial fishermen into the classroom so that students can interact with them directly. The sanctuary also has a program called Voices of the Bay, another in-class education program. There's three elements to it. One is called Balance in the Bay, which is sort of a computer simulation where students can adjust things like fish abundance and X vessel value and look at what happens to both fishing communities and the resource. From Ocean to Table is sort of a role-playing exercise where students can take on the role of all the different parts of the commercial fishing industry, from the boat operators to the mechanics to the buyers to the processors to the retailers. And then Capturing Voices of the Bay is a program where students are sort of coached into how to research and conduct interviews, and not just with commercial fishermen, but with all people in the community of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. Volunteer programs are a huge part of the sanctuary program, and in addition to just getting help to do the kind of work that needs to be done, it sort of it promotes stewardship and creates an entire army of people who have sanctuary issues top of mind, environmental issues top of mind. These are four of the programs: Snapshot Day, First Flush, and Urban Watch are all water quality monitoring programs where volunteers go out, take water samples, and analyze them for contaminants and pollutants. Team Ocean is a program where volunteers go out in kayaks, and they help kayakers understand how to interact with wildlife in a way that doesn't harm wildlife. And Baynet are volunteers that walk along the shoreline. In Monterey and Pacific Grove, there's this beautiful bike path. There's marine mammals everywhere, and Baynet volunteers just interact with people that are walking by and help them understand what's going on. There's resource protection programs. This may be the largest share of what the sanctuary does: water quality protection, enforcement, emergency response, which often takes the form of making sure that oil and fuel from stranded vessels don't enter the sanctuary, and issuing and administering permits. The sanctuary is a science-based organization, and they have made a huge investment in understanding ecosystems, and they've launched a research program called the Ecosystem-Based Management Initiative. The four goals of this program are to help maintain and restore ecosystems in the sanctuary, to identify and protect unique and rare habitats and ecosystems, undertake research to try and understand human drivers of ecosystem change versus natural drivers of ecosystem change, and to help identify and promote sustainable uses of sanctuary resources. I was going to call this a short-term benefit, but I couldn't decide, so I just left it in the long-term column. A Sea Grant fellow by the name of Oren Fry worked in the sanctuary office, and during his tenure there, he came up with this idea of starting a community-supported fishery in Monterey, and he calls it Local Catch Monterey. It's not the first community supported fishery. I think the first one in California was actually in Morro Bay, but he started one in Monterey. It currently has 162 members, and it appears to be off to a great start. The way this works is that you can become a member. You sign up and pay $20 to $40 a month. and you will then get a weekly box of seafood, and you never know what you're going to get, but you do know that it's going to be local and fresh. And the Oren works with a very small number of fishermen who said, yeah, I want to be part of this program. It provides fishermen with a more predictable and a steadier source of income, and to me, this is just a great example of how sanctuary can contribute to sustainable economies. The Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary is fortunate in having a huge, well-developed research community. There are over 50 research organizations in the sanctuary with over 2,000 faculty, staff, and graduate students with an annual budget of over $250 million dedicated to marine research. And the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary partners with many of these research organizations, contributes to them, and provides actual assets such as research platforms, this research vessel, research aircraft. The sanctuary undertakes beachcombers, which is a regular beach walking program where stranded marine mammals and birds are documented. The Sanctuary Integrated Monitoring Network, SIMON, is kind of a metadata program. Metadata are data about data. And the SIMON program is designed to be a one-stop shopping. If you want to know what research programs are monitoring what aspects of sanctuary ecosystem function, you just log on to SIMON and you'll find out about that program. You can get data from the program. And there's also, by the way, a great video, photographic archive of underwater marine life on the SIMON websites. And the sanctuary also supports the Sanctuary Currents Research Symposium. This is an annual research symposium that gets regularly around 300 people at each one. So those are just, that's just a quick snapshot of some of the benefits that I see the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary brings to local economies. And I understand we have some time afterwards. I'd be happy to chat further. So thanks very much for your time.
Thank you for that, Chris. Oh, by the way, I'm Andrew Christie. I'm the director of the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club. We are very happy to see this day finally come. We are now going to go to a brief panel discussion where our panelists will chat amongst themselves, essentially, and then seamlessly segue into a Q&A session with you folks. So anybody who has questions for them, if you could just come up to this microphone right here, much obliged. But I will just kick that off with any particular topics you might have in mind, or I am interested in hearing personally about how you handle relations in Monterey, Santa Cruz with the local fishing community and with the local ag community, and how do you handle the criticism that Lois briefly touched on earlier, there's no money. These are hard times, so this isn't the time to start talking about additional sanctuary protections. And Cynthia, this is not your first time at the rodeo in San Luis Obispo to talk about national marine sanctuaries. Cynthia came down to address the San Luis Obispo Chamber of Commerce on this subject, their environmental subcommittee. I think, now that I'm thinking about it again, it was 2006. So we've been at this for a long time. I think this is the most substantive event we've ever put together, and I'm very glad to have Cynthia back along with your three distinguished colleagues. So if you could begin to address any of those questions or anything else you think is more topical.
That's a good start. I will just start by saying that the fisheries part of it would not be my strength. Dan has a lot of experience in that area, so I don't know if you would like to handle that first. Really, what I came prepared mostly to talk about, because the issue as it was presented to us, was what's the impact of sanctuary designation on local business. And as part of my work on the Santa Cruz City Council, you know, we all get committee assignments, and mine have been broad, but have included serving on our Conference and Visitors Council, our Chamber of Commerce, our Downtown Business District, which is dependent both on local patronage and visitors. So that's really what I wanted to talk about, was the benefit of the sanctuary designation for our local economy and for our local businesses. So shall I just take a few minutes to do that? Is that okay?
Perfect.
Con su permiso. What we know about our Santa Cruz County economy is that tourism is one of the largest drivers. We can argue between tourism and ag, but really tourism is huge and has been for about 100 years. Our boardwalk was built in 1906. I put some pictures over there, old and new. They go back about a century. But the way we interact with the ocean has changed enormously in that century. Other big parts of our local economy as it has evolved, certainly education, active outdoor lifestyle, specialty food and beverage, arts and culture. These are all important segments, but I think when you think of all of those, they're very complementary, and having a spectacular natural setting is important to all of those. That's what we find across the board, whether we talk to high-tech executives or whatever. They say, what do you really like about living in Santa Cruz? The environment. So I think having that as an underscore is important across the board to our environmental health. So as was mentioned, the sanctuary was designated in 1992. And very shortly after that, a group got pulled together in Santa Cruz. I served on it to think about, well, what next? And this is, I think, getting to the question that you asked to us. It included someone from our port district, someone from the local cities and the county, from education, from some nonprofits. I think, Dan, you probably sat in on that. What is the economic benefit that we can derive from the sanctuary designation? We knew there would be an environmental benefit. So the question was, how can we develop this? And with very little money, just a little seed money, $1,000 here and there, and some staff support from the county, we met regularly, and we said we worked with a consultant and identified three things we thought could be a benefit. One would be to develop and highlight a sanctuary scenic trail along our coast with some interpretive features. One would be a sanctuary seal program where we'd ask businesses to become sponsors and publish a simple little brochure that we could get out for visitors. 10 ways to get your feet wet in the Monterey Bay Sanctuary. That's a really kind of a modest little project, but we did that. And the other was to have some kind of a visitor center that would draw attention to the existence of the sanctuary and what it meant. And as we all know, you look out over the ocean, you see the ocean. The challenge of the sanctuary is to create education and concern for what's underneath. So that was our charge, and it was very incremental. We went out and got grants, but in fact, we did all of those things. And it was that discussion and resolution to try and explore a sanctuary visitor center that down the line in a few years led to the city of Santa Cruz donating its prime piece of real estate. You know, if you've been to Santa Cruz, you know where the boardwalk is, you know where the wharf is. We gave 3/4 acre right there for the construction of the Sanctuary Exploration Center, because as a city and as a community at large, environmentalist business people, we knew that that would be an incredible addition to the beach area in Santa Cruz, the economic benefit, and it would be an incredible advantage to the sanctuary in terms of reaching people for education and outreach. About 3 million people a year go to the boardwalk. So that's a great location to intercept them and create awareness, appreciation, and a desire to protect the sanctuary. So those are the things that came out of a very modest organizational effort, and I have to say it was long. You know, this is a long campaign you're involved with, and it was long for us, too. We're about to open the Sanctuary Exploration Center. I put something on your table there if you're interested. Tell us a little bit about it. Most good, ambitious, complicated projects take a bunch of years to achieve, but we're very proud of that. Another thing that I thought I would just touch on, and I hope you don't mind my just doing it like this, I came prepared, so I wanted to talk very briefly about the role of our Conference and Visitors Council, our tourism promotion entity in Santa Cruz County, in being a part of this effort. The CVC was restructured about 15 years ago, plus or minus. is to include a third of its board members from the public sector, which were the major funders at the time, a third of its board members from the industry, that would be hotels, attractions, and so forth, and a third of its members from environmental and cultural groups, with the growing understanding and appreciation that these were big attractors. So both Dan and Randy have served on the Conference and Visitors Council at various times, Dan representing O'Neill Sea Odyssey, Randy, the Friends of the Santa Cruz State Parks. And that, I think, has really reinforced the CVC's increasing work in promoting not just the beach. I mean, the boardwalk promotes. They get the day visitors. Our goal was to bring in the overnight visitors, the shoulder season, the off-season visitors, and that we had so much to offer, not just in terms of the beach, but the environment, the active lifestyle, the arts and culture, and that those, as I said previously, were very, very complementary. The CVC did a survey, and they found that 73% of the visitors a couple years ago came for the beach. About 15% came for active lifestyle. But those are not mutually exclusive. So increasingly, they have helped to promote the sanctuary. They've been active in that. And I put on your table also the most recent Conference and Visitor Council guide. And the centerfold is the sanctuary. It's great. It also has a section on exploring the great outdoors. So that, again, it's the active lifestyle that depends on a clean ocean and the businesses and facilities that support that. And finally, as was mentioned by someone else, in our South County, Watsonville-Pajaro Valley, birding, again, very much related to the migratory flyway. So there's increasing appreciation of what it can mean to our local businesses. I'll also just mention that I said I'd been active in our downtown business district, and you think, well, downtown, it serves the local people. When I talk to our downtown merchants, they say, certainly the local customer base is important, but we live or die on tourism. That's the margin for them. So they also fully understand that it's the quality of the environment, the appeal of the environment that brings people here and keeps them here. And they fully support what we're doing. The beach is not their backyard, but it's important to them. So I think that's kind of the basics of what I wanted to convey. When I looked at the marketing material of our various ocean-related businesses, most of them don't say on them Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. It's kind of a mouthful and long. So I would just echo what Dan said, that it's what you don't see that's the benefit. They all market the beautiful view, the outdoor activities, appreciation of the environment, and that's there because of the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. So it's almost that hidden benefit that I would say we take for granted. And I see that's one of our challenges as the Exploration Center comes online, is to make that connection between the sanctuary and our local business community. But it's a very receptive group.
Thanks so much. Mm-hmm. Mr. Wadera.
I don't have an indoor voice, sorry. I come from the Pajaro Valley and a very entrepreneurial background with my father and my parents, and I came here sort of to talk numbers, and really specifically is how do you make money off a sanctuary, you know, as a business person. And even though I've been in the nonprofit world for my whole career, it was really the sanctuary which opened up a door that helped me start a nonprofit that grew to $1 million a year, employing 30 people, transitioning to another nonprofit that grew to employing 70 people locally, and really attracting people to the area who then began other entrepreneurial type of activities. And I really see my relationship with the sanctuary and all the work that was happening with the sanctuary that sort of drove that. And it was actually, I was driving down from Fort Bragg last night to my home in Santa Cruz, and I was listening to the radio, and they had a speaker that was talking about Apple Computer. And I know it's very popular to talk about Steve Jobs and Apple Computer, but something really resonated with me, which totally made me think about this presentation today and how you might frame why it is important and how you can, and this top one in your flyer here says, provide a legacy of sustainable, healthy, local communities and economy. And for all the faults that Steve Jobs had and all the things you can point to Apple as maybe now being the new evil empire, not Microsoft, they said that they were focused on product. Apple is 100% focused on product. They don't, it's about nothing else. It's about their product. And I thought so much, and as they were talking about the culture in Apple and how everybody, they don't talk about their salaries, it's not about the money, it's about being part of this team that's creating this incredible product. And I thought about the efforts of people like Cynthia and Dan and the environmental movement, and the case that this man was making from Forbes was saying how most business schools teach business very different than the way Apple does, and how people should start looking to Apple as the new business model because of their focus on product. And I was like, yeah, but people didn't like Steve Jobs if they worked for him. But what I see and what I've seen happen is by focusing on the sanctuary, about the natural and the cultural history all around our area, what people have done in our area with the sanctuary sort of leading is we've focused on our product. We have focused on the fact that we have this incredible natural and cultural place that we want to share it with people. And then what that has allowed is people with me, like me, who have this entrepreneurial spirit, then what we're able to do is we're saying, okay, well, what are the ways that I can create a living here? And that was really my, I grew up and I on this old apple farm, and I was in this old ranch house, and we had this empty barn. We didn't have any agriculture there anymore. And I was out of college, and I'm like, well, what am I going to do? You know, and I had that example of my father who had started several companies and had done ranching, and he had evolved with the opportunities that were around him. And what I knew that I did, I knew that I loved taking kids and be out of the doors. And what I did was I was starting to think, oh, maybe I'll start a school. What the heck? The first document that I picked up was this incredible, voluminous document where they were talking about they wanted to start this sanctuary. And they developed all this information. And so that was the beginning of the brand for me, is that when the sanctuary started, when people started to focus on wanting to do this preservation, they started to get to know the area. They started to document, know what the economy was like, what was driving it, what would be affected. And by taking that real hyper look at our community, then people like me who could say, oh, here's where opportunities lie. I was sitting at a table with two people, one Thomas, is it? Yeah, who has sort of, you know, a kayak business, and then, I'm sorry about the other, Teresa, who does environmental education. And it's really, those are two of the backbones of what has driven the economy, at least from my perspective, is you bring people here to learn, to understand. You have the entrepreneurs who are starting educational programs, or they're leveraging the universities or anything that's going on there. They're able to develop businesses. People that I hired started businesses in mountain bike manufacturing, in Hobie Cat sales, in ecotourism. You know, you really create, and it's that brand, it's that product that is what your community is. So, and what happens is, and this is what, in Apple, this is what they do so well, is how you see yourself and how the outside world sees yourself all comes together. And that's really the brand that is what I see that has allowed me to then build the businesses, albeit nonprofits, but then from that came the for-profit businesses that also. A perfect example, and I'll kind of end with this, is with the Friends of Santa Cruz State Parks, we were able to grow and leverage this sort of product and this brand and this focus to develop all kinds of ways to bring in resources to fund educational programs, and then actually funding the state parks. And what we were able to do is we took a branding approach, and it's been very successful. And by just giving sort of, and so we have all these state parks, and so we basically hired a very high-level graphic designer, had a campaign called That's My Park, and then we use that sense of a place, that product, that is the sanctuary, that is the natural beauty. And this was able to raise over $250,000 for the organization. But more than that, it continued to focus on the product and help us bring more support to our organization. So again, from somebody who wants to make a living, who lived and grew up in an area, and you know lots of those people, young people, you know, now I'm old, now 50, you know, but you know those people, they're 20, they're right out of college, and they're like, I love this place. How am I going to make a living here? You know, and to me, it was really having this backdrop that allowed me to leverage that.
Yes.
I'd like to answer your question about fisheries with a quick story about a success story in Monterey Bay. The Stagnaro fishing family has been in Santa Cruz for 150 years. They used to be a major economic force, and as fisheries declined, members of the family had to fend for themselves. So there's a gentleman named Kenny Stagnaro operates out of the Santa Cruz Harbor, and he has begun a very successful whale watching business. He has gone from being one of the expert fishermen to being an expert on gray whales and humpback whales, and he is one of the few businesses in the harbor, which is a seasonal enterprise, very hard for boats to actually make a margin in that harbor. He actually is able to pull it out, and it's a great success story. And just to answer your question about how to deal with fisheries, the fishing community when the sanctuary was formed was largely neutral, whereas they had been previously opposed to previous sanctuary proposals. The reason for that is Leon Panetta, as member of Congress, insisted that there be language in the original management document that relegated fishery regulation to those agencies that had been doing it up until that point, which is Cal Fish and Game, National Marine Fisheries, Pacific Fisheries Management Council. Over time, it's been a process that requires a lot of patience, a lot of dialogue, and trust. And yes, there's been criticism, but you work through that.
Good to hear. Okay, any questions for the panel? If you have a question for any of them, please just come up to this microphone here.
I have a question for the panel. We're kind of unique as far as San Luis County goes because our larger population centers are 10 or more miles from the water. Santa Cruz is right on, Monterey is right on the water. So how do we bridge that and promote that with those inland communities that are a strong voting power in our community?
It's my impression, correct me if I'm wrong, that tourism is a major component of your economy here as well. Is that a correct understanding? Yeah, number one also, yeah. So similar with agriculture not far behind probably. So I would think beginning a conversation with your tourism promotion entity or entities here, and as I mentioned in my comments, you do have the educational institution here, and I think the environmental attractions are complementary with many of the other things that you have here as assets, the wine tasting and so forth. So really probably doing some market research and seeing how you can take advantage of those. I will say our CVC invests at least every 5 years in some highly credible research, so they're getting the pulse of trends and also building partnerships to take advantage of that. A suggestion.
I don't know if I have a specific answer, but I will note that in Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, the sanctuary has forged a very positive working relationship with the agricultural community in the Salinas Valley. And that's been through a partnership in which the sanctuary works with farmers to help develop voluntary best management practices that ensures water quality of inputs into the sanctuary. And I don't know how you can use that as a marketing tool to convince inlanders that the sanctuary is a good idea, but I just point that out as a really positive, and one wouldn't think that it would be, but it's been a very positive working relationship between the sanctuary and inland communities.
I have a little insight, and it's about you know, knowing your customer. Mm-hmm. When working with Friends of Santa Cruz State Parks, we had five visitor centers, and I'll use an example of New Brighton State Beach, where what we realized is we were building this new visitor center right there at New Brighton, and we realized that there were communities from the Central Valley that basically always go there. And it's like they're more locals than the locals because they've been coming to New Brighton for, you know, five generations. And they see that place as being part of their home. So we took the approach when we started to try to educate about the sanctuary and try to educate about all the things that they could do is that, number one, is we made the visitor center relate to them. We acknowledge the fact that, hey, we know where you're coming from. And by the way, we know that you know this place, and then we took this approach of educating about other places that they could go where they would feel that same sense that they felt when they came to New Brighton. So, I would imagine with your community here being based on tourism, there's probably these hot spots of places that come here. And creating those linkages then really empowers you to help them not only sort of enhance their experience, but, you know, you can direct them to the kind of services that they would need. It's knowing your customer, but at the same time, knowing your customer as somebody who's cause-related like me, it helps you educate them, too.
Thanks for saying that, Randy. I was going to say it. If you didn't, everybody goes to the beach. Mm-hmm. Sierra Club's coastal activists, and probably the same is true for Surfrider in California, are all over the state. They're not just clustered on the coast. So if we're waiting for someone else to come up with a question, I will certainly continue. Got a question?
There's a question right here.
Teresa?
Thank you. First, I want to let people know that there is a monumental effort to get the environment as an integrating context for learning with all our schools in California. And it's called EEI. And there's a lot of marine science education in it when it talks about weather and water and politics about the fisheries, examples of Channel Island, ecosystem habitats. It's californiaeei.org. And we just want to encourage everybody to support your local school's effort to get that into the school system, California EEI, Environmental Education Initiative. I guess the question that is facing us all is, like, how? We want this. You know, is it going to take an act of Congress from Lois? Does it take money? Does it take letter writing? I know you guys have a campaign, but I'm not sure exactly what are we doing, you know, to make this happen. What's the answer to the how for bridging the gap, like you're saying, expanding it to this?
Very quickly, there's two options in terms of the technical how. First is to look at the next management plan review for Monterey Bay and try to convince the good folks there that moving the boundary south is a good thing. Or the second is an act of Congress, which would be Congresswoman Capps. And typically in that situation, you'd have to show a pretty strong coalition, which would include agriculture and tourism.
I wasn't involved the way that Dan was in the formation of Monterey, but I'm living with the consequences of the sanctuary, and I would emphasize what Dan said. It's about coalitions. Mm-hmm. The commercial fishing industry in Monterey is not on board, I would say, with the sanctuary, and it has been an ongoing issue. And I think at the outset, forming a strong coalition that avoids those sorts of long-term tensions is really important.
Anyone else? Yes.
Thanks so much for being here, everybody. I work for a winery, and they are also an old fishing family that's been in this area for decades. And they probably represent a lot of old school thinking that they're convinced 100%, which is why I volunteered to come to this, because I work for them, and I love them, and they're great people. But they're convinced that the sanctuary would squash the fishing industry totally. They hang out with, you know, fishermen. They've been here for four decades. And so I'm trying to take information back to them to try to convince them to not think like that. And the winery, we enjoy pretty good business in these economic hardship times because we are in a beautiful place. Mm-hmm. That's why we have business at all. Mm-hmm. So, but then I'm hearing about in Monterey where there's still bad blood or whatever between the fisheries and the sanctuary. So that's what I want to try to work with them, is that it doesn't have to, but it sounds like there still is some bad blood with the fisheries.
Thanks for that question, because it gives me an opportunity to build on my earlier comment, which while there is a persistent voice among some commercial fishermen that feel that the sanctuary is a bad thing for them, there is, I think, a growing feeling, especially among younger fishermen, that have a different perspective. And this community fishery is a really good example, where these are fishermen that were willing to step out of the old paradigm that the sanctuary is going to hurt us, and thinking, you know, this is an example of where the sanctuary was actually a positive benefit for them. I think the main problem with the commercial fishing industry is they're just getting hammered in so many different directions. I mean, being a commercial fisherman, think about it. You know, there's been a 70% reduction in the number of fishing vessels in the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary from 1992 to the present. Fishermen that come from Sicily and Italy that are in their 70s and 80s look at that and say, look what the sanctuary did to us. I've heard this. I've heard this in a city council meeting. Look what the sanctuary did. Before they came here, there were 100 boats, and now there's less than 30. So there's this view that sanctuary is federal government is regulation, regulation hurts us, therefore it's the sanctuary's fault. The other thing that happened is that Dan alluded to this, in the formation of the sanctuary, the fishermen will tell you, the older generation fishermen will tell you, Leon Panetta made us a promise. His promise isn't in writing anymore, but he made us a promise. And that promise is that the sanctuary would never do anything that would restrict fishing activities. I've never seen the promise. It's not written down anywhere. But what is written in black and white is the designation document. That, in my opinion, is the promise. And in the designation document, it's very clear that fishing regulations are under the jurisdiction of California Department of Fish and Game and the National Marine Fisheries Service. And if there are resource protection issues that are affected by fishing activity, the sanctuary is directed to work with those agencies to resolve it. That's the promise. But also in the designation document, it goes a little bit further, and it says if it can't be resolved and if some satisfactory solution doesn't arise, there is a process through which the sanctuary can enact regulations that could affect fishing. It's that threat that has this small group of commercial fishermen in a position that, in my opinion, they will never come on board, because that idea is there. We've had Leon Panetta come to a Sanctuary Advisory Council meeting. He would not clarify the promise. He's too smart a politician, I think, to do that. So that part is out there. And in my opinion, what will change that is attrition. Mm-hmm. I think there's just that idea is there. It's going to be there until the people that hold that idea aren't there. But if you look at the sanctuary's track record, identify a single regulation that the sanctuary has enacted that has restricted fishing activity. Zero.
That's right.
None. If you look at what else has the sanctuary done to promote commercial fishing, sanctuary in a classroom. I mean, tell me a commercial fisherman that has a program that advances the virtues of the sanctuary. No, they're not there. But here the sanctuary has school programs that promotes fishing culture, the heritage. So I think if you look at the data, if an objective person investigated this idea, they'd see that sanctuaries are actually friends of commercial fishing. And then if you look at the long run, two or three generations from now, resource protection will, there's no doubt in my mind, that resource protection will enhance fisheries through improving ecosystem health and ecosystem services. It's a tough issue, and I think one that as you move forward, it's good to think about. And you're already off to a good start. There's this great relationship between Cal Poly and commercial fishing, where fishermen and researchers have initiated a research program to quantify the impact of trawling on bottom communities. And commercial fishermen and researchers are working very closely together in a very harmonious way. That's a great start.
Did you want
to? No, I was just going to say that's a very accurate description of what's in the designation mm-hmm. document. Again, look at the success stories. You have fishermen who are now developing niche businesses, very successful businesses. I mentioned Kenny Stagnaro. Part of his business are the small recreational fishing charters that they can do within the seasons, within the limits, and the fisheries are declining anyway. So the success of these younger generation of fishers is going to show that, in fact, it can be done just in a different scale that's been done before.
And can I add one more thing? There is a paper that EcoTrust just put together about the socioeconomics of fishing in the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary. And while the number of vessels has declined by 30%, the ex-vessel value of fish coming off the vessels is the same or greater than it was in 1992. So they're not making less money. There's just fewer fishermen doing it. And by the way, we can thank Ronald Reagan for doing that, because he is the one that extended the exclusive economic zone out to 200 miles and overcapitalized the fishing industry to take advantage of this vast new resource, way overcapitalized and way overexploited. So the only, you know, it's natural that the effort's going to have to go down.
I wanted to go back to the question that was asked here or someone about getting your inland population centers to support the ocean protection. And Dan was mentioning in the course of the conversation, I think it was his conversation with some legislative staff, that you will hear some very loud voices against it, but in the polling, in what the electeds know about their constituents' attitudes, there is very strong support. And I can say as an elected, that's not an uncommon dynamic. There may be very broad community support. It just sits there. It's quiet. It doesn't manifest itself. But I do think, as others have mentioned here, there's I would talk to your electeds, others who may be in a position to shed some insight on this, on the broader underlying attitudes, even in your non-coastal communities. But also, it does seem to me, as others have alluded, there's a real generational movement here in terms of great concern among younger people, great affinity with environmental issues. And I will say, as Chris, he showed the picture of his dad and grandchild. I mean, there's nothing like having a child or a grandchild or great-grandchild to give you a further horizon of what you care about. I do think that with the changing attitudes of young people and people really thinking about what's the longer-term prospect, even for the immediate people I care about, that is a very profound concern to tap into. And it's not just I live in the wine country in the foothills and that's the ocean. I think increasingly people really do see the world as a web of life. And secondly, I wanted to just mention on that topic also, engaging people who may not live right on the ocean and therefore care about it. Engaging students. Dan's program, which you really haven't talked about here, is ocean-based environmental education, and particularly for lower-income students who don't come from ocean communities. And it's amazing what a fairly brief experience can do to imprint on them some core principles and concern and change the way they see the world. I don't know if you want to.
Just very brief. Very briefly, ocean-going, standards-based science, we provide, it's free, we provide bus transportation, mostly lower income, mostly Latino populations, East Santa Clara County, and it's amazing what hands-on on the water can do. You go back, any outdoor educator will tell you, go back thousands of years, that's how we learned, it was outdoor, we made our way around the world. It's amazing how science suddenly becomes very clear and the concepts become very obvious to students who otherwise get bored in front of a textbook. The point here is that we were doing a long-term study of our program. We're finding that the kids' view of the ocean depends on their geographic location and orientation towards the ocean or not, but in fact they are able to make the connection through the watershed. Through mental modeling that we've done, see that they understand non-point source pollution, they understand the connection to the ocean, maybe it's a different perspective, but that's the connection and they're getting it. So it's a matter of communicating that connection, that integration.
Time for one more. Yes, sir.
I have a question about the being a marine sanctuary and with alternative energy, like wind and tidal, is there any room for that in a marine sanctuary? I know the oil, you know, drilling is detrimental, but what about wind generation and tidal energy?
I'm not sure the National Marine Sanctuary Program has developed a policy or a position on that. I've heard part of the debate, and I like I said, I go to these annual national meetings, and Dan Basta is the director of National Sanctuary Program. And his opinion is he thinks there is a way that alternative energy and sanctuaries can coexist, and I think he pitches that. I don't know if Dan's listening. I'll probably get killed. You know, I don't know if he's listening to that. This is what I recall. And he pitched it in terms of coastal zone management. So if you take a holistic approach to coastal zone management, then you set aside different places where different activities happen. And the key is to keep them from getting crossed up. So I don't know if the sanctuary has an official position, but the national director didn't exclude it for sure. You had a question. Or one of your first questions I wondered if I could address was money.
Yes.
Like, how can you suggest adding a new sanctuary when funding is so limited?
Right.
And this came up at the national program, and the staff showed this graph that indicated that sanctuary designation of new sanctuaries in every case preceded the funding level. So it took a new sanctuary for the national program to say, oh, well, we've got to allocate money to this new sanctuary. And so from 1972 to 1992, the curve of increasing sanctuaries led the curve of increasing fund to them. Now, it's a different financial world, so we can't predict that that's going to be the case. But they were making the point was if you're waiting for more money to become available before you designate a sanctuary, you may never designate a sanctuary.
Actually, the same thing happened with national parks in the 1930s. That was probably their greatest flowering and renaissance was the depths of the Depression. Dan?
Just on energy, the California Coastal Act does see energy as a priority development, especially coastal-dependent energy, and marine sanctuaries by necessity must be integrated federal, and there's federal consistency, et cetera. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you can get there. It's a project-by-project question.
Well, I hate to do this, but got to wrap it up, and I just want to do a little housekeeping. Be sure you signed in when you came in, and if you didn't, please be sure you do so before you leave, because we need to keep in touch with you and let you know what the next steps are and what you can do to help move this along. So when you sign in, please don't make us guess what your email is, if your L's look like R's. Nice, clear printing with the order of the day. And also, please tell your friends about what you heard today. Consider yourselves self-appointed ambassadors of Sanctuary in San Luis. To help you out, the first thing we're going to send you is going to be the web link for this video. And thanks so much to Bob Lloyd and his stalwart AGP video crew for recording this for posterity. There will also be a broadcast schedule, Channel 21, Bob. So you can get that too. This information is about to become widely available, and you can help get that word out, and that's going to be a crucial part of this effort going forward. Finally, Dan and Randy and Chris and Cynthia came down here today on their own nickel at probably $4.25 a gallon and volunteered their time to give us all this great information. So let's thank them. Let's thank Congresswoman Capps, and thank you all for coming.